Welcome to the Fun Manifesto, you all. Thank you for spending time with me. It is my honor and privilege to introduce you to a truly incredible artist and what he calls a cultural architect. He is a dear friend, in fact, my best friend. He is my partner. He is someone I look up to who works extremely hard at his craft. And mark my words, in the coming months, if it takes that long, but certainly in the coming years, you will know this man's name. He will be in every house, on every corner, in every car, knocking every beat. I really, really believe in this man, and I'm excited about the work that he's doing. So without further ado, I introduce you to the one and only Damon Turner.
Peace, everybody. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Yeah, thank you for being here. Before we talk about your artistic journey, I want to ask you, which I'm sure a zillion people have asked you before, what the heck is a cultural architect?
Shout out to a brother of mine named Sean Mitchell. I used to work for an organization called CD Tech, Community Development Technologies in South LA. And their main mission, vision was to bridge the digital divide in the hood. And so they built a computer lab at the historic Dunbar Hotel on Central Avenue. And I was blessed to work in the space. Naturally, and I give thanks to my mother and my father, who always have been communal in how they approach any work that they do. My mom always becomes the community mom. My dad is always in every room shaking everybody's hand. And so naturally, I think that gift of, you know, pulling people together, making things make sense, has always been in my life. And so when I worked at this lab, I was an intern with an organization called Public Allies, but I would always ask, can we, you know, do film screenings or art classes for these youngsters that keep walking past the window but never come into this lab, you know, or the youngsters who do come in to get on MySpace because there are no other computers in the community, right? And so I started organizing, you know, events for young people. And so one day, Sean Mitchell like walked by me after a focus group that we had done and was like, bro, you're a cultural architect. And my whole life, I've always wanted to be an architectural engineer. Mm. You know, I wanted to go to Georgia Tech and, you know, do all of these things. I love the idea of making things make sense, simplifying things, finding the mechanical value in things. So when he said those words, I had never heard them put together before. And this must have been 2010, mm-hmm. right? I never heard those words before. And I've spent the last, 15 years thinking about it, mm-hmm. 13 years thinking about those words. And so, you know, he assigned that name because he saw how I would hold space for the community. He saw that how I would, you know, use culture to make, you know, spaces vibrant, but also relaxing and disarming for people to connect with each other. And that to me is what I think a cultural architect is in the world, is someone who's unafraid to put people in a room who historically would never be in the same space, finding what common themes there are that connect us all, and, you know, amplifying that, exploiting that in the space. And ultimately, you know, I think ideally I would love for any space that I create to spark an idea that pushes the culture forward in love and joy and progress and fun, you know. And that to me, I think, is the value of cultural architecture. You know, the elevator pitch is like, think of an architect, you know, people who look at blueprints, create blueprints, who are able to see, you know, three dimension from invisible, right? You're able to see the building on just like a vacant plot of land. And so I think, when it comes to culture being able to reverse engineer spaces, when it comes to culture being able to forecast what's getting ready to come in the zeitgeist, and finding really beautiful ways to bring people together. And the people that I genuinely prioritize in the work that I do are historically, you know, marginalized folks, Black folks specifically, who come from abject poverty, because we also deserve to see ourselves as beautiful and worthy of visibility and investments. And so I do my work primarily for those folks, but not excluding, like, you know, we talk a lot about the historically poor white communities. You know, I'm from Georgia, and, you know, Black folks and white folks alike are raised together, right? And so you see a lot of abject poverty in the rural parts of Georgia. And so we share a lot of common issues when it comes to capitalism and those who are ultimately not favored. And so, you know, my spaces are for folks who don't have strong reflections of positive, I think, representation. And so, yeah, cultural architecture.
I mean, I've seen some of your work in the past. I've seen you pull together incredible events like Uplift. I've seen videos of your greenhouse. I am so sad I was not around to see that. The greenhouse, will you tell folks just a little bit about what the greenhouse was and why you decided to architect that vision?
Yeah, we were invited, my company Trap Hills was invited to envision art that spoke to capital punishment, that spoke to the work that Bryan Stevenson is doing, and connected to the film Just Mercy that had just released. And unfortunately, a lot of people who were getting a lot of grants and just a lot of money in the art space were doing things that were either really corny, right, or you know, traumatic.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think recreating Khalif Browder's prison cell and touring it for people to walk inside of a 10 by 10 space to understand the psychology of what prison does to people is art or makes sense, especially for people who have been traumatized. Exactly. And so, you know, we decided to flip it all on its head and create, you know, a greenhouse. You know, Trap Hills, since its inception, has used the elements of foliage, nature, to communicate the idea of healing for our community. Trap is a lifestyle created in the South, but it's age old, as this country is. You know, organized crime, black market, economics, you know, but in the South, folks use abandoned buildings to sell out of. And it's riddled with hypermasculinity, is riddled with, you know, toxic masculinity, is riddled with hatred and disloyalty and all of these things. But it's also riddled with, you know, stories of resilience, stories of entrepreneurship, stories of family, stories of love, stories of, you know, determination and integrity, really. And so the heels piece of the trap is what we want to begin to exemplify. And so the juxtaposition of nature in an urban environment, I think, is to create a sort of oxymoronic tension for a bigger conversation to be had. And so, you know, we always try and inject foliage in any space that we create in the hood. And so the greenhouse, we built an actual functional greenhouse, 72 feet long, 20 feet deep, 26 feet tall, in the middle of South Central, and more specifically across the street from the Magic Johnson Theater, which is in the jungles. And, you know, the spot that we ultimately, you know, took over for, you know, 12 days is a trap. You know what I'm saying? It's a space where people get busy in a parking lot. And so as we were doing this project, you know, the community was coming out, like, asking what we were doing and what is this that's being built and whatever. And we, you know, we told them that we're building a safe space for people to just be seen. And the art that we put inside of this greenhouse reflected folks who were incarcerated serving any level of life, mm-hmm. whether it's 30 years plus life or the death penalty, right? Oh. People who are ultimately losing their lives in prison. But we partnered with Ben Caldwell and the Lemur Park Phone Company to repurpose to reimagine what the visitation experience can be. Mm-hmm. Taking portraits of people who are serving life that they sent us, mm-hmm. that they themselves see as, you know, the best representation of themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember Miss Tony had makeup on, or, mm-hmm. you know what I'm saying? She, other folks were just like showing themselves in their light. And we partnered with Damon Davis, who created a really beautiful pieces of art with these images. And we repurposed these old phone booths to pick up the receiver, press one, and you hear them tell you their story in their own voice. You press two, you hear the family members in their lives who love them and support them mm-hmm. from behind the wall. You press three and you hear, you know, our incarcerated family tell you how you can support their work of, you know, abolition. And so it was just like, how do we humanize folks beyond a data point mm-hmm. that we often... You know, we relegate our folks who are incarcerated to 2.2 million this and 4 million that, you know. But no, that's Miss Tony. That's JJ88. That's, mm-hmm. you know what I'm saying? And so that's what the greenhouse was. And it was a 12-day pop-up. Every day, you know, we had conversations. We had events. We had local businesses selling wares and food. Shout out to Tammy's Tasty Tacos. And, yeah, we just turned up. And we made sure that when people came to the space, Black people who are from the community, they saw themselves. So we didn't promote it outside of the community. Mm. The community, word of mouth, mm-hmm. told each other yes. about this thing. And so it wasn't a zoo experience for folks who had potentially just come home from prison mm-hmm. And who were having these very cathartic moments and spiritual breakthrough moments. We had CBD-infused massage therapy in the space. We had trauma-informed acupuncture in the space every day for free for folks. And it was a really beautiful healing experience. And so that wasn't the brief version of that, but it's important to give the full context for how we think about and the pedagogy that we use in how we present art in spaces. It's really to disrupt the status quo and do things that are really beautiful and lifelong.
Yeah. You know that at FUN we believe in leveraging art for social change and using the things that we see and the things that we hear as a means to finesse the imagination. I believe really strongly that what we hear and what we see impacts what we imagine, and therefore what we imagine is possible.
Period.
And so what you did there, every time I hear somebody talk about it, I can tell how it impacted the way that they saw themselves and their community. I really, really love that about the work that I've seen you do with Trap Heels. Before we move on to what you were doing before Trap Heels, can you give me just a brief explanation of what Trap Heels is exactly?
Trap Heels is a prayer. Mm. Shall I expound?
Yes, you shall.
Okay. It's a prayer, first and foremost, two words that have never been put together in the history of language, because it literally is two conflicting ideas. Mm. Again, the trap is a place where a lot of pain lives and communal harm lives, and heals has been ultimately, you know, whitewashed as an idea that is only accessible to people in yoga pants. You know what I'm saying? And so the idea of putting these two words together is really a prayer that we can heal the trap, heal within the trap, with the means of what is in the trap, like with ourselves. We are the currency that can heal the trap. In a very practical way, we designed a creative agency, a cultural architecture firm that is here to inject culture, whether it's through experientials, whether it's through content, whether it's through fashion, whether it's through music, whether it's through strategy and consultation or investments, or even how we protect and secure our own communities, we are an agency that ultimately hires and implores folks from our community. We train folks in our community to see themselves as the quote unquote gatekeepers of our culture. Mm-hmm. To ultimately teach folks, everybody in our community, how to leverage their IP, their intellectual property, for their value. And if they want to partner with people outside of the community, then great. If they don't, then we have the mechanisms inside of our community to make a ton of money and disperse a ton of money within our community. And so, you know, we are, I consider us like a beta test, you know what I'm saying? It's a petri dish of ideas at the Trap. And so we, you know, we want to ultimately be like Trap 2.0, right? Like what the Trap can be. Mm-hmm. When you reimagine capitalism, when you reimagine masculinity, when you reimagine all of these tropes that we've ultimately had to wrestle with no tools, we're a space to explore, and it's like a playground. You know, we're here to explore these ideas and push things forward.
I'm really inspired by the fellowship that you have inside the Trap. You have. Are you willing to talk about the investments that you've made in housing and so forth?
Sure. Yeah, totally. You know, we call our headquarters the Trap. Some people call it the Well. Depends on what kind of day it is. but, you know, my Aunt Jerry's house was always the house that everybody would go to after church. Mm-hmm. Before she passed, my Madea's house was always a house that everybody went to for Sunday dinner. My mama's house was always a house that the community would come to, and it was never really a formalized thing. It was just what it was. Mm-hmm. And those are the stories that I take with me, and the way that I organize space is I open my space for people to pull up. And so naturally, because of the work that we're doing, you know, folks who are formerly incarcerated in my family have tapped in, you know, for safety reasons to be in the Trap, you know, and it became a fellowship. It became a safe house of sorts. The resources that we have as an agency, we invest into people. And so taking over, you know, a living space in South Central, converting it into an office space, converting it into a music studio, converting it into an art studio, converting it into housing for folks is really the point. So if you ever, like, everybody in my family had at some point in their lives lived at my Auntie Jerry's house too, or lived at my Madea's house. Right. You know what I'm saying? Like, cousins lived at my mama's house, right?
Classic Black family story.
You know what I mean? And so that's really the point of what this space is a sanctuary. And so if we're able to formalize it in a way that creates a program that, you know, gives folks 12 months plus to get their lives in order, and then ultimately learn along the way, oh shit, I see people in the studio, like maybe I can make music, or damn, I see this dude cutting and sewing something in the living room, maybe I can be in fashion, or I really love gaming naturally, damn, I didn't know it was an economy for that. Mm-hmm. And we're investing in these things, then easily folks are able to pipeline into these different verticals that we have inside of Trap Hills, and or pipeline them into other spaces, you know, relationships that we have with folks. One beautiful idea that I'm really cultivating with Chris Martin and Coldplay is an idea of how to, you know, train new roadies, right? Mm-hmm. To be able to go on tour, world tours with global artists, and creating a stomping ground for people to really get that work in. And so these are the type of projects that I'm really excited to prioritize and invest in, similar to the work that you're doing in the food space and conversation that we've had before around how, like, Billie Eilish and her team are, you know, building food, like building in the food justice space and environmental justice space, and, you know, how to find local farmers and find local food vendors to cater at every stop and, you know, on these major tours, right? Just like, how can we disrupt the status quo is really important. So long short is, you know, we're really just a space for people to come be seen, be free, and feel invested in every step of their journey.
Any funder out there that is listening, I implore you to support the work that Trap Hills is doing. I'm watching firsthand as this organization is transforming lives. healing people, reuniting families, getting people the spiritual, psycho-spiritual base that they need in order to thrive. And I think the thing that inspires me the most is that this place doesn't lead with an idea of what it means to be successful or to be powerful. It leads with an understanding and a reverence for each person's individual genius, mm-hmm. and that their individual genius is an important currency that then flows back into the system.
Absolutely.
And I'm really, really excited to see what happens next with that.
Thank you.
Are you willing to go back into time and talk a little bit about your time in BLM?
Sure. Yeah.
So tell us, what is your origin story with Black Lives Matter?
Once upon a time, there was an organization called Bob's Plan. Day one, you know, day zero, day negative five. I was doing cultural architecture work in South Central for, 3 years before the founding of BLM. And meeting Patrice and meeting Melina, meeting, you know, a lot of the folks on the ground that really, in LA specifically, that created what is now a global movement, sparked something in me, I think, then that really has transcended where I have gone in my life and ultimately where I'm going in my life. And I give thanks for that. So I was there, you know, before BLM was actually the name that everybody was using. BLM was created from a coalition called J4TMLA, Justice for Trayvon Martin, Los Angeles. After Zimmerman was acquitted, you know, we took to the streets. The country took to the streets, really.
Yeah.
But what we were doing locally was, you know, was turning up in the name of Trayvon and also in the name of Marissa Alexander, who was also in Florida, fired a warning shot against her abuser husband and was ultimately sentenced to heinous, like a life sentence, some weird shit, but couldn't you stand on your ground?
Right.
And she didn't kill anybody.
Right.
And so we were protesting and uplifting Marissa's name as well. And so through that time, I was creating content, you know, music. I made a song called Marissa, working with Maxwell Ade and Giovanni Solis. We created a video for Marissa, Prayer for Marissa. And that was the first ever piece of content that had BLM hashtag on it in the world.
Ooh, you better make an NFT out of that.
You know, everybody's trying to find their way. But that's, you know, that was the first piece of content that was used. And so I did a lot of the behind the scenes graphic work, photography work, organizing events, you know.
There's a legendary party that you had at the beginning of the BLM movement that I've heard so much about with you and DJ Fatrick.
Yeah, shout out to Fatty, shout out to DJ Bonds. They had an event called Libre, and it was just beautiful vibes, and we began to partner with each other and like create safe spaces for people post a protest who have all this energy from literally standing in front of law enforcement who needed a safe outlet.
Right.
So we would party. We would go to spaces and play, you know, turn up music and anthemic protest music. And that's when I also realized that, oh man, there's like power in the music. I mean, I always knew, you know, the Nina Simones, you know, Aretha Franklin and James Brown and all these folks using their platform for justice, Harry Belafonte, rest in peace, you know. And so it just clicked for me, like, this is our time, this is our moment. And shout out to like Damon Davis, Steph Poe, and all these really dope artists, man, who during that time were speaking to the issues. And so things began to die down after Trayvon Martin's ignition. Mm-hmm. Mike Brown is then killed, and it just picks right back up. And everybody clinged to the hashtag Black Lives Matter as a rallying call. And you know, that was really when everything took off, you know. But I've always been there doing the cultural architecture work, behind the scenes. Yeah.
Trapping the cure, as you would say.
Yes, for sure. And shout out, it's always important for me to always shout out St. Elmo Village, you know, Miss Jackie and Mr. Roderick opened this their sanctuary for the initial conversations of BLM. And there were a host of people who were involved behind the scenes on the ground to bring this conversation to light, who have never had their names written in the paper, who have never even pushed for visibility around the work that they did, the sacrifices that were made to make this thing as big and as bright as possible. And it's to those folks that I definitely give thanks and pay homage to, you know what I'm saying? The Pabi Tamus, the Mark Anthony Johnsons, the Fumi Lolas, the, you know, Jasmine Richards, the, you know, just a lot of heads, man. The Jazz Wades, the Haywans, the fuck, like just a ton of folks, you know what I'm saying, who really turned up, man. And you know, it's so funny, like shout out to Rosa Clemente, like we were all on trial for shutting down the 101 freeway after Darren Wilson was acquitted by a grand jury, man. And like, you know, it was deep, you know what I mean? And so, yeah, we've been there from the jump.
I appreciate your stories and even the names that you're shouting out. Some of them are artists' names that I recognize. And this is a perfect segue into not another part of you, I would say more an extension of you as a cultural architect, which is your personal artistry. Your music has been healing for some time. As I listened through your catalog years and years and years back, and everybody who's listening to me, wherever you stream your music, go and find it. And in fact, you find some of his music on thefunmanifesto.com right now. But go and listen, because this man has a track record of Trap and the Cure, as he would say, creating music that speaks to our experiences as Black people, has the rhythm and the timbre and the energy that speaks to our experience as Black people while speaking positivity, and not in that corny way. You know how, like, you know how there'll be a movement and they go find, you know, some backpack rapper to go hippity hop hop on a song and then call it culture. This is not that, y'all. This is the truth and the way and the light. But tell me about your musical journey. I know your mom had quite a lot to do with that in your early development.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I was born in a family of musicians. On my dad's side, all of my aunts and my uncle were singers, you know what I'm saying, gospel singers. And, you know, on my mom's side, she was a phenomenal poet, singer, dancer. Growing up, there was always music in the house. And as a kid, I remember my sister and I, you know, doing variety shows in the living room whenever company would come over. And so I've always had a level of art, a level of entertainment, a level of performance around me. I'm grateful that I didn't have parents that obsessed over that and forced us into a particular discipline, because I saw that happening around just a lot around me. But, you know, I could never shake the bug. I always had to listen to music. I always had to be creating something. And so my mother passed away in 2008. 2009, I moved to Los Angeles, and I decided to just go for it, you know, take the thing that I was playing with or that I was kind of teasing and make it the thing that I'm focusing on. So spoken word became sort of my primary way of expression. Shout out to Amir Suleiman, pointing me in the direction of the Poetry Lounge. From that space, I realized that, I want to create spaces for artists who, you know, aren't interested in popularity contests, who want to just get free, you know what I'm saying? And so we created a space called Freedom Friday. Shout out to a lot of the early folks like Kim Williams and Nikki Black and, you know, a lot of folks who really supported making something special happen. From there, I became what, you know, changed my life, I think, forever, an art and cultural director at Mercado La Paloma. And that helped me understand how to institutionalize art in a way that can really raise capital and also raise the spirits of people that were around me. Mm-hmm. And so I took over the space. It was a very daunting task, but it became home. And so, like, just having a consistent space, that's when I realized the power of land, the power of ownership, the power of just having a space to create in. I created some of my best stuff, best ideas, because I had tools for the first time,
right?
You know? And so that really helped inform everything that I was doing. And, you know, in 2013, when BLM was created, you know, everything, it just felt like all the stars aligned, just everything clicked. And I had been doing the work to build the discipline around throwing events, around creating music, around, you know, creating content and creating products. And I just literally pivoted all of my energy. At the time I was in a collective called Greedy City. Greedy is an acronym for a generation righteously enduring to eradicate dying young. Mm. We were also artists. We had a house on the east side of South Central, and we were just creating out of that space. And so I was leveraging the Mercado for things I was doing at the Greedy City house, and just creating just nonstop. And then when BLM popped off, you know, I pivoted all of my energy to BLM. And so I remember when we when we were on trial, and shout out to Osceola, shout out to Nana Jumphy, names that I didn't mention before, but I had made a song called, you know, hashtag BLM here. Mm-hmm. And my boy Daniel French from the band Las Cafeteras was the one phone call that I got. And I called and I was like, hey, bro, you gotta release the song. Here's my Bandcamp login information. We need that right now.
You are a true artist.
We need it. I'm behind the wall, bro. We need it.
Trapping the killer.
Trapping, bro. It was hilarious. But this particular song, the hook literally says, Black Lives, They Matter Here. On repeat, Black Lives, They Matter, Black Lives, They Matter Here. And when we got out of jail, Jasmine Richards literally took the hook and started saying them at rallies, at protests. Mm. And that became the Black Lives, They Matter Here chant.
Right.
That everybody around the world has chanted. And so that's a glimpse into, you know, where my artistry started and ultimately how I began to use it for, you know, changing some discourse and fueling, hopefully, you know, folks to feel empowered when they're just in the world. And now I'm doing that, but differently. I'm not focused necessarily on the anger or on the protest. My protest now is through love and through joy and through vulnerability as a 6'4" Black man to sing, you know, tender songs about love, about fear, about, you know, faith and hope, in hopes that this can also help soothe folks who have been on the on the forefront of an emotional war for the last decade. And so, you know, that's how I want to use my artistry today.
That is beautiful. For those of you who are listening, like I said, make sure that you search I Am Damon Turner everywhere and listen to his music. The last two records, he has really jumped into this bag of vulnerability, of singing more. Can you tell me about the process of creating The Healing and the process of creating Hughes?
A lot of shrooms.
Shout out to psilocybin.
And having the tools at my hand to wake up and explore what I'm feeling that day. The Healing EP was not necessarily written. I think 95% of it was sheer channeling emotion. And my engineer, Brendan DeCora, really was able to help create a sound.
The wizard.
And we naturally just, you know, got busy. And so I wanted to take that same vibe and apply it to something even more vulnerable, because the Healing EP was I'm going to sing some of these songs, but I'm going to also rap just to remind people that I'm a rapper. But the Hughes is like, nah, bro, I'm going to sing these covers and make them my own. Mm-hmm. You know, as I'm exploring what singing and songwriting looks like, I'd rather take some lyrics that already speak to how I feel and reimagine them. And so that was the process of Hughes. You know, we be feeling. Black men be feeling stuff, you know? We have a lot of feelings that we suppress. And so it was really cathartic to have a space to share.
That is beautiful. Both of these albums are beautiful. All of his music is beautiful. One of the things that I truly love is often an artist will make a pivot and you're like, what? Hard left, right? These records, I feel, are healthy progressions. You're not leaving behind being an MC's MC. But, you know, this new record, I don't know if there are any real actual drums on the whole thing, right? But there's still that bass heavy slap. The things that we love about his previous music are still there in terms of the depth and the integrity in the music. So I encourage everybody to do all that you can. Don't pass go and do not collect $200. Sit your ass down and listen to some Damon Turner. Get your life. Thank me later. Do you have anything else you want to share with the people?
Nah, other than thank you. You know, I know it's been a lot of work to get to this point with the Fun Manifesto and the sacrifice you've put into the space. And so I'm just grateful to be chosen to share on this platform. And you know, if there was one thing I can leave with folks, it would be to take a deep breath and remember that you're still here.
Lashay.
You know, and that I promise you that, you know, if you just put one foot in front of the next, and not in the cliche way, but literally put a foot in front of the next, or, you know, however you move, just make sure it's forward.
Lashay.
It will get better, and plant seeds of love, and I promise you they will come back when it's needed. I'm feeling that now, and the randomness, that's not so random, of the right people hitting me at the right time to say either the right thing or offer the right opportunity is really profound. And so, you know, keep the faith.
Ashe and amen. Well, on that note, again, go find Damon Turner absolutely everywhere, including on the Fun Manifesto, where you can download some of his music, because it's important to support independent artists. So don't just stream his music, buy his music, buy his merchandise. Go to his shows and spend money, because creatives put their whole life into what we share with you all. And it means the world to us when you support us financially, as well as sharing and telling people to listen. All right, off my soapbox. See you soon, Fun Bunch.